This talk was given by Patrick Yunan Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
So, first of all, thank you for coming and for your time and attention. I hope this is beneficial to you. So today I'd like to talk about reverence or respect and humility. And I'd like to begin by doing something which some of you may be familiar with, but some of you perhaps not. It's a land acknowledgement. So I'd like to acknowledge and pay my deep respect to the Lenape people, elders and ancestors, past, present, and future. I offer deep gratitude to this Lenape land and water that supports us. And I invite you to join me in that acknowledgement, respect, and gratitude. So the Lenape are, of course, the Lenape Delaware, the people who inhabited New York before the before it was settled, before the encounter with Europeans. And I first heard this. This has become a bit of a thing. I first heard it from Greg Snyder, who is the teacher down the street at the Brooklyn Zen Center, at a gathering that I attended on the Buddhist Action Coalition. And I noticed that I had a reaction. I felt uncomfortable when I heard it. And I was examining what that was. It actually felt unsettling to me. And I realized I was vaguely aware of this sort of history and the karma. But it was not part of my conscious experience. And so it was literally like, you know, talking about the earth, the ground like that, it was literally like the earth was moving beneath me, how I imagined the earth, how I related to it. And of course, that's unsettling. But over the years, and with a little bit of practice to help me, I've come to be able to trust when I have certain feelings of unease, of dis-ease. And in a sense, it's a sense of like coming up against your own blind spots. You know, of course that's uncomfortable because you're right up against what you don't know. That's perhaps the thing that terrifies us the most. But, you know, from another perspective, that not knowing, it's a sort of buried treasure. It's an opportunity to manifest wisdom and compassion more fully. So the impetus for this theme, I said I wanted to talk about respect and humility. There were two events. The first was the youth climate march that I attended, even though not much of a youth. A few weeks ago, with a number of you, actually, as well. And I was deeply touched by all the young people out there. And I guess I would say the expression of love for this earth. And another experience was I was in Grand Junction, Colorado, back in August, visiting Choco, who some of you know. He's a senior student. He had an accident, and I still don't know what happened. Choco's kind of like that. But he broke a few ribs. And so my partner Sokyo and Ryan, who some of you know, went out to visit him. And he was staying at a friend's, and I sat out there, and it's Red Rock country, Grand Junction. And so I was sitting out at night, hot summer night, you know, the smell of sage on the air. And I sat for about 2 or 3 hours and watched the moon rise over a butte. And I grew up out in that area, so I have a deep connection with it, but it's, you know, it's very painful for me to go back there. Just because of the extent of the development. It's not the development so much that people are there. It's more that the it feels to me the sort of disrespectful way in which it's done. And I don't mean to, like, get up on a, you know, high horse or anything, because this is the culture that we have, you know. It's all of us. I'm a part of it as well. But it's difficult to see. But so I think the antidote for this disrespect or perhaps arrogance is humility and reverence. And I'm talking about reverence for the land, but I am also, you know, reverence for each other as well. You know, the reason I like that, I started with that land acknowledgement, I felt that it brings together in a nice way respect for people and respect for the land. Coincidentally, the Beyond Fair Differences group is meeting upstairs. And for those of you who may not know, this is a group that's been working on, I guess the main thrust has been issues of inclusivity and equity, especially around race, but not just, around all sorts of issues. So they're, you know, from a bunch of people from the monastery are upstairs meeting right now. But there's a number of people who've been working together on this for years, really. And they recently came up with a set of 10 values or guidelines that they distributed to other people in the Sangha. More, I think, in the spirit of just offering these guidelines to out of their work, sharing it with the rest of us. And as it happens, two of the values, and it's not like they're just making these things up out of thin air. These are really, it's Buddhist practice, perhaps with a particular emphasis, but it's essentially just Buddhist practice. So two of the values that they bring up are humility and reverence. And so I want to read, there's 10 of them. I'm not going to go through all of them, but this is what they say about humility. To cultivate humility is recognition of the depth of our own conditioning and the vastness of the path. And then the other one was reverence, a deep respect for each other's humanity and identities and the transformative power of the Buddha Dharma. So humility, I'll start with. I think the most important thing to say is it's not the same as humiliation. You know, it's hard to, looking back at my own experience, I think I'm only, after practicing for a while, I'm only just starting to get a sense of what true humility would be like. I think for you know, even if I know intellectually that it's not the same as humiliation, I think that's how I habitually apprehend it. You know, the word humility comes from a Latin word, humilis, which means low, insignificant, obscure. But if you trace it back a little bit further, there's another Latin word, humus, which means earth, soil. So humility is of the earth, of the soil, if you go far back enough. It's also cognate with the word homo, as in human, homo sapiens. So human, of the earth, humility. I mean, in the history of the words, it's all there. But this proximity of the two meanings of humility and humiliation, I don't think it's just me. It seems like something about, I don't know, this time and place, it's how we apprehend it. I think that humility is not a virtue that's very highly prized in this culture right now. I don't think I'm going too far to say that. But it's, you know, it's not really sexy on the surface either. But it's, there's a lot there. And I think you could say that in a very fundamental way, Zen practice is a practice of humility, of true humility, which is, maybe you could say, maha humility. It's a humility so large that it doesn't leave anything out. It's not humility opposed to being high or low. And for me, one of the most poignant expressions of this humility is the practice of doing prostrations. So we did it. We did, you know, everyone here did the service. We did prostrations. Suzuki Roshi, some of you may be familiar with him. He once said that after Zazen, prostrations is the most important practice that we do here. Or another teacher, Sheng Yan, if any of you are familiar with Sheng Yan, he was a Chinese Chan teacher who, he taught here in the city for years. He died about 10 years ago. But he, at one point, he did a hermitage when he was in Taiwan, I believe, for a number of years, 3 years, 6 years, something. And, you know, I had always imagined that during a hermitage like that, he would probably do Zazen all the time. It turned out that he was doing prostrations, mostly. He had served and he'd been inducted into the Nationalist Army during the Chinese Civil War. I think perhaps he felt he had karmic baggage, if you will, to purify. So what kind of humility is expressed through prostrations, though? In the Bible, in the book of Job, if you're familiar with this story, Job is a righteous man who experiences tremendous suffering. He loses his children, his livelihood, his health. Throughout all of this, he affirms that he is a righteous man. So how is it that a righteous person could suffer injustice? And all of his so-called comforters say, no, you're not really, you know, you're missing something. God would not punish a righteous person. And he stands his ground. At the end of the book, God appears out of the whirlwind, and there's this magnificent display of divine splendor. And Job's response is, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now I see thee, now I have seen thee with the eye. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. That's one way to put it. You know, I think I first I understood this sort of I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes as a sort of humiliation. And I, you know, I'm not Christian or Jewish or I don't even believe in God actually, but perhaps through Zen practice, I can maybe hear a different side of this, where it's not so much abhorring oneself as it's a sort of joyful surrender to the divine. But even so, it's sort of it feels a bit drastic to me. When I first came to Buddhist practice, I personally had a really hard time with the prostrations. You know, I would do it, but I'd be like, you know, what the hell is this? I couldn't stand it. Because it felt like submission to some sort of authority, whether it's the MRO, the institution, the religious, organized religion, the teacher, whatever. You know, I would do it, but with my gritted teeth. And that happened for years. I think, but in some way, I think there was I had enough trust that I, you know, I was able to trust that there's something else going on here that I don't entirely see. So I stuck with it. The Buddha's way of encountering reality or the divine is it seems a little bit different or a little bit gentler to me than that of Job, which is not to say one is better. You know, sometimes I think a more drastic approach is required depending on where we're at. But on the eve of his enlightenment, the story goes, Shakyamuni was confronted by the armies of Mara, who is a personification of delusion. And this happened for several hours. He was, tempted. At the end, he simply touched his fingers to the ground and called on the earth as his witness. And it was that simple act that precipitated his final breakthrough. And the story goes, he saw clearly his nature all the way to the bottom. And then he exclaimed, "Wonderful, wonderful. I attain the way together with all beings in the great earth." So, I spoke about my resistance to prostration starting out, and more I experience it as a sort of whole body expression of the Buddha's gesture of touching the ground, not with your fingers, but the whole body going down the ground to the earth. Wonderful, wonderful. Together with all beings in the great earth. The earth does not argue, is not pathetic, has no arrangements, does not scream, haste, persuade, threaten, promise, makes no discriminations, has no conceivable failures, closes nothing, refuses nothing, shuts none out. Of all the powers, objects, states, it shuts none out. So this is Walt Whitman, actually, but I think of this as a very clear expression of what I think of as earth wisdom, the wisdom of the earth. And in my experience, we can invoke this when we need it by practicing prostrations. A number of years ago, I was very upset with Daito Roshi, even though he had been dead for years, I don't know. But you know how these things go. I don't even remember what I was upset about, and I guess that's probably for the best. I'm not anymore. But at the time, I realized that I had to do something about this. And so I started, whenever I was at the monastery, I would go up to his grave and do prostrations, or at the stupa, do 108 prostrations. And it really shifted it for me. I still now, whenever I'm up there, like for session, I try to find some time to go do prostrations at the stupa. And I've found from that, you know, it's a really good practice if you're having some sort of issue with, if someone's pushing your buttons, whether it's at work or a family member or someone here or, I don't know, political figure. You can put something that reminds you of them, a picture or some object, on an altar and do prostrations. It's powerful. You know, it doesn't mean, especially, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to agree or submit to them. This is, again, it's not humiliation. You don't have to, it's not like that. But I think of it more as invoking that wisdom of the earth. Closes nothing, refuses nothing, shuts nothing out. And, you know, you may not even notice at the time. I often just do it and I don't particularly notice any change in my state of mind. But it does, I can guarantee you it has an effect. For you, even forget about the other person. And related to that, so I spoke in the beginning, I quoted the value that spoke of the vastness of the path. You know, the teachings are everywhere. It's not just teachers that teach. All beings teach, all of reality teaches constantly, ceaselessly. Usually we don't see it. I think the reason we don't see it is because we don't have, we're in our own way. Humility is the key. I mean, I think of it more as like, you know, if you want bad enough to really plumb the depths of the Dharma, which, you know, not that I have, but humility, I think, is necessary. And then humility, the way that it's, I think it naturally moves into reverence. I think reverence or respect is perhaps the expression of humility in the relative world, in the world of this and that and other people. You know, respect, the expression of respect, it concerns the peculiarities of another person's humanity or another being, another existence, even non-human beings. You know, people are very different. We're all very different. Beings are very different. We live under very different conditions, circumstances, socially, psychologically. But how do we respond appropriately? I think fundamentally, you know, this is a question of etiquette, of good manners. Or in another way of putting it, it's a question of responding in accord with time, place, position, and degree. In a sense, it's nothing special. It's just, like I said, good manners, just common decency. You could think of Zen practice as just training for years and years to be a decent person, to be a mensch. And again, there's a certain, I think there's the same sort of dualism with respect or reverence that we have with humility. The word etiquette, at least to me, it can sound sort of old-fashioned, stuffy, maybe a bit elitist, artificial, inauthentic, politically correct, or that it somehow places constraints on one's freedom. If any of you are familiar with Philip Kaplow, he was an early Zen teacher in the U.S. He went to Japan in the 1950s to study Zen. And he, going over there, he had this sort of very iconoclastic, antinomian view of Zen. You know, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. You know, tear down all the idols. At one point after sitting, he was doing a service with the Roshi, the teacher there. I don't know if it was maybe Yasutani. And he asked him, you know, why do you bow to the Buddha? I thought you were supposed to spit on the Buddha. And Yasutani's answer was, you may spit if you like, I prefer to bow. So there's a lot of forms around here. You could think of those as a lot of rules, ways to do things right and ways to do things wrong. What to wear, where to sit, how to hit a bell, what color robe you're wearing, how to hold your hands, beginning a meal, ending a meal. Everyone does the same thing. Where's the freedom in that? But these forms are not like divinely ordained. We chanted earlier this morning, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Gary Steiner speaks of the etiquette of freedom, the expression of freedom through forms and rules, or manners. You know, a couple of years ago, Shugan was down here giving a mondo, and somehow people got on the subject of small talk. And he said, you know, I really like small talk. I've really come to appreciate it. You know, we talk about the weather or so, but it's a way of approaching another person and, you know, we have to go through these little rituals. You know, it doesn't work. Someone's like, how are you? I'm really miserable. Let me tell you about, you know, my history with my mother. And, you know, it's like too much. But we can also get attached to the forms. And sometimes the forms need to change. Reality is not fixed, and so the forms can't be either. Out of compassion, you know. Sometimes you need to be a little bit of a, maybe a bit of a rascal or a wild woman. One more story. I was at the monastery years ago. I was living there with my partner at the time, and we had been going through a lot of difficulty, and we spent 1 week pretty much bickering. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone trying to work through a relationship on the schedule at the monastery. It's pretty intense. But after Hosan had started, and if any of you are familiar with the grounds there, some of you are, there's a big lawn, and where the greenhouse is, it used to be, there was nothing there, it was just a meadow. And there was a bench up beside a tree. So we were way up off the road, way up on this high lawn, this meadow up across the mountain. We were sitting there trying to talk things out. And Dido was coming back. He used to have his, you know, he'd drive up to the monastery with his Jeep and then drive back to the Abbey afterwards. And he's driving back along the road. And all of a sudden, we see the Jeep just peel off the road and start driving across the meadow. I'm like, what the hell is he doing? He comes over there and he drives up next to us. He sticks his arm out the window and goes, you all being nice? Right. Yeah. He turns around and drives off. So, all the forms here are basically upaya, skillful means, the robes, the bells, the hierarchy, the building, the order, teachers and students, even the practice of Zazen. They're provisional. But being deluded human beings, we need provisional methods. We need to practice them meticulously and painstakingly as best as we can. But ultimately, it's not about that. I think I said this at the half-day sit a few weeks ago. Zen practice, fundamentally, it's really not about anything but the liberation of beings. All beings, self and other, human, non-human, living beings, dead beings, beings that aren't born yet. In the Diamond Sutra, Subhuti asked the Buddha, Bhagavan, if a noble son or daughter wishes to set forth on this bodhisattva path, how should they stand, how should they walk, and how should they control their thoughts? And the Buddha replies, Subhuti, those who had now set forth on the bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. However many beings there are, in whatever realm of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor non-perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I vow to liberate them all. And though I liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.